bought me a ring, fallen asleep, the sound of your breathing, wide, wide eyes like, this is my house, this is my life now, this is my spouse, glory be, glory to you, glory to me.
That face when you forget you had a podcast.
Here we are.
That reaction when,
yes.
You know, your face when
an epic fail happens.
Oh my God, did we epically fail because we haven't recorded this thing in 2 months?
No, we succeeded because we're following suit. This is what happens. Every episode we go, sorry, you forgot we had a podcast.
Oh, that's right. No more. This is a little glimpse of behind the scenes because we have a whole team. And we've got, like, our social team and sometimes our producer, Maria, like, just absolutely drops the ball. And then sometimes, like, she doesn't press record and, like, Stacy just blanks out, spaces out. And I'm like, pay attention, girl. We let you go off work
grid.
For, like, a month when you went to see the Eras tour.
Follow the Eras tour around.
Yeah. And we're sitting here and we're like, we haven't had a producer in 2 months.
So what are we supposed to do without
So that's
them?
Actually why we didn't record for
that's
a while.
It.
Yeah, because one of our employees was off at the Eras tour.
This is a meta lie.
This is a meta lie.
Yeah.
Should we tell real lies?
Yes.
Because real lies,
real lies.
That's it.
Yeah.
Fucking nailed it.
Honey, how many horses have you purchased recently?
7. Oh, is this the beginning of a lie?
No, I just because you were so busy and...
I feel like every time you leave me unattended, I'm either gonna bet on a racehorse, buy a horse, ride away on a horse.
Become a horse.
Exactly. Or get surgery to look more like a horse and elongate my face. That is manic life. I'm manic. I did something horse related. And everybody else like, what?
Oh, brother, not again.
Also, we're both sick, so
yeah,
you're getting me on like a day 2 of a DayQuil drip.
I feel like a Looney Tune. I have like, I like cried like 4 times today. The first time was because Cher has a new Christmas song.
Y'all, it's really good though. It's not one of your obsessions, is it?
No.
It's what is it called? DJ Play Christmas Song?
DJ Play a Christmas
Y'all,
Song.
Y'all, it's really good.
It made me cry. I saw a clip of Santa coming out, and that made me cry. And then I started crying for no reason because my period's coming soon.
Yeah,
it's just like,
Mary
I'm
was like,
emotional.
She was like, I cried several times while watching the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade.
I was like, I've never watched this before. I don't know why. It's because I was making a pie and I was feeling very wholesome.
The pie was absolutely unreal.
Thank
Mary
you.
Absolutely nailed it. I mean, nailed it, made every part of it from scratch, did like the lattice shit on the front, on the top of it. I cried while watching Kitchen Nightmares.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, yeah. We cried a lot.
Yeah. So let's tell some lies.
Okay, I love it.
If y'all just happen to be in the mood, if you support us on Patreon, it's patreon.com/manicepisodes, you can get a lie told about you. And who knows when. Could be years from now. Depends on when we get around to doing this shit.
Oh, no. We are headed for a natural disaster.
Dun, 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 dun.
And horses.
You were alluding to it. You were.
No, I just added that.
Okay, good. Okay.
Our local dentist, Crispy Trattner, is at it again, duping people and adding extra teeth.
Oh,
thank
Crispy.
God. Thank God. Jen was outside of the dentist store and heard this abomination happening and reported it to the local authorities.
Did you, and what was your state of mind when you came up with Crispy Trattner?
I don't know.
Crispy Trattner.
Crispy Trattner.
Adding
to say.
You just
I
always,
was driving.
It's like, you have to think that these dentists are all in some kind of a cabal together. One of them adds the extra teeth. So then Jen has to come in, go to the dentist store,
and report. Stop adding teeth.
It's all a scam. Are you familiar with the energizing power of nature?
Yeah, kind of.
You know, like when you go, on a specific kind of hike, or you look at a particular kind of foliage, or you step on a really crunchy pine cone, and you feel energized,
okay,
right? Take
yeah.
a swim in the ocean.
Yeah.
Well, are you familiar with the energizing power of CeraVe?
No.
That's right. CeraVe is known for inspiring energy and enthusiasm in just about everybody she talks to.
Oh.
And that's awesome. But
oh.
ExxonMobil is actually investigating CeraVe as a possible energy source to exploit.
Oh, no.
And capitalize off of. So watch your back, Sarah.
Oh, Sarah, I'm so sorry.
I know. This is unfortunately, some of us have to grease the wheels of capitalism, you know, but you have to be careful when you show the world what you're good at.
It's not fossil fuels, it's skeleton fuels.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's your soul, man. It's
in your bones, Sarah.
It's your soul, man.
So we are in the liminal season between fall holidays and winter holidays.
It's all a blur.
Which means people who love to decorate are in a constant state of slide puzzle with giant tubs of shit.
Isn't that the truth? And sometimes actual shit because they've been in the garage and rats get into it.
You know, we've all been there.
Uh-huh.
And also, hardcore Christians are afraid to go outside because there are still some witches and vampires in front yards.
That's true.
But Cat D has come up with the solution to this absolutely non-existent problem. It's a spooky nativity scene.
Oh.
Imagine baby Jesus in a manger surrounded by Dracula, Frankenstein, and a whole bunch of pumpkin heads.
That is the holiday. That's the holiday mashup.
You can keep it up for months.
That is the holiday mashup. Well, that's why I left the string of reddish lights on the balcony. You took them off.
Those are purple.
No, they are not. Well, but I thought they could. You didn't like them for. I was like, let's just leave them up for Christmas. And then I came home from a trip, and they were gone.
Purple's Halloween.
Okay. Sometimes you just need a friend to talk to, and more often than not, that friend is Katie B.
Aww.
In fact, Katie B. is such a wonderful friend who offers such steadfast support to her friends that Katie B. is being investigated by ChatGPT as a possible source code for an AI bot. So just watch your back, Katie B.
No!
I'm just telling you, be careful.
Oh, no. Not everyone getting exploited.
Do you have another lie?
No, I'm all lied out.
I have one
more. But you have another one.
Bonus. Bum, bum, ba-da. Okay. You know that friend who would do just about anything for you?
Mm-hmm.
If you needed, let's say, skunk spray for your dog at 10 p.m., this friend would go to the nearest pet store and pick some up for you.
Yes.
Shout out Andrea, who was a guest on the pod. Well, that's Mel M for you. Oh. Always available and always willing to run an errand and be the hero of the day. I feel like that would be Mel.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's awesome. But Mel, you need to know that Amazon is actually researching you as someone they can enhance with their supply chain technology.
Oh, no.
So watch your back.
Oh, my God. Everyone being exploited. Everyone being mined.
I don't want anybody to be taken advantage of.
This is terrible.
I want to protect all of our little manic babies out there in the world.
Yes.
Whether you're manic baby, depressed baby, or some combination of the two, we want to take care of y'all. What we wanted to talk about today is not just sort of the world in the wake of what happened in the Middle East on October 7th,
mm-hmm.
but kind of the state of the conversation. Like, not even that, but like the state of what kinds of conversations we're having.
Yes.
And where the spaces are for those kind of conversations. So this is an op-ed by Elizabeth Spires that was in the New York Times on the 17th of October. And I just want, I am not reading this as an endorsement of these views. I am reading this excerpt as a possible launching point for this conversation because you haven't heard this and I want to know how you feel about it.
Okay, great.
So she wrote, "There's a facile version of taking a stand on social media that generates righteous backpedaling but reduces complex issues to a simple yes or no. Taking simplistic stands can lead to twisting words. Concern for Palestinians is portrayed as support for Hamas or hatred toward Israel or Jews in general. Anger about Hamas's attacks on Israeli citizens is portrayed as denigrating the dignity of all Palestinian lives. This kind of thinking is deeply unserious and further fuels hostilities, warping nuanced positions into extremism and making tweet-length expressions of outrage, mistaking tweet-length expressions of outrage for brave action in the face of atrocity. Knee-jerk social media posts are not what bother me most, though. It's the idea that not posting is wrong somehow, that everyone needs to speak all the time. It discourages shutting up and listening and letting the voices that matter the most be heard over the din. It implies it's not okay to have uncertainty about what's going on or any kind of moral analysis that does not lend itself to presentation in a social media post." What do you think of that?
I was a little bit on board initially because I think, like, that was one thing I think that bothered me, where it was like, you if you wanted to express, you know, hey, this is fucked up shit that Israel's doing, like, you'd have what felt like, I mean, I feel like I still have, you know, comments still rolling in that are just like, what about October 7th? Why won't you denounce Hamas? You know, all these sort of things. And I feel like that was really frustrating to be like, that was bad. We're talking about this thing now. This is the thing we're talking about now. So, and I also agree that, like, it's frustrating to be like that. My challenging of that, my challenging of the state of Israel and the IDF as a state, as a militarized
right
state,
as a state, not, as a yeah. state enacting foreign policy, essentially, yes, right?
Exactly.
Or domestic policy. Yeah.
And being critical of that is seen as anti-Semitic, I think, is the most infuriating part of all of it.
Of you speaking out.
Yes,
because
exactly.
We can get back to this, but you
yes.
did speak out.
Yes.
And a lot of people have not.
Yes.
And okay, so you were with the Post
yes.
up until a point. And
yes.
then where did she lose you?
She lost me saying that there is a pressure for everybody to speak out and that it needs to be okay to not say anything. And I understand that. I understand where someone's coming from. I understand that where she's coming from. I understand there are a lot of people that are just like, I don't want to say the wrong thing, and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, and I don't feel educated about the topic.
And you've heard this privately from some people
yes.
that you know who are also public figures.
Yes.
They're apprehensive.
That feel that way. And while I understand, I also think that if there is not enough public opposition to something that is happening in real time.
Yes.
But you're watching a genocide in real time and you're not saying anything, nothing. I think it would be more understandable to have that position if there were a lot of noise in terms of support for that position.
Sure.
Right. I don't
you mean like if it were like. Like, let's say in the wake of George Floyd's murder,
right.
where it seemed like across the board, at least for a moment there, support for Black Lives Matter and this kind of like consciousness raising about police brutality. It was like that would be an example of like,
yes. where
there was already a lot of discourse.
And
is
I
that
think,
what you mean?
Yeah. And I think that would be fair if you're like, I'm still learning. And so I want to just sit back and absorb some of the discourse and really take time to really understand what's going on. There are a lot of people voicing their support for Black Lives Matter, so I'm just going to listen.
I feel like you did that initially.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're right. The reason I brought this up is because I'm not a public figure, obviously, like only in like some microcosm, teeny tiny, very niche way, like within your orbit. I'm not complaining about that, by the way. That makes sense to me. I haven't said anything, and I read that, and I was like, that, I think, what she's saying here, what I mean to say is, like, oh, that's what I would have said, but now that I see it in writing, I hate it.
Why do you hate it?
Well, okay, so she says something later in this piece. She says that posting on social media, basically, does not leave time or space for people to process traumatic events, as you sort of just alluded to, in the sanctuary of their own minds, or to gather more information before pronouncing a judgment. Mm-hmm. It pressures people who don't have an opinion yet or are working out what they think to manufacture one and present it to a jury of total strangers on the internet who will render an instant verdict on its propriety. The reason I don't like that is because I think what she's doing, and I think what a lot of people have done traditionally, and they're frustrated that they can't do this, is to participate as some kind of an aesthetic that is like universally celebrated, that looks good optically, that doesn't step on anybody's toes. And if it does step on somebody's toes, like if you post something about Black Lives Matter on Instagram and somebody gets offended, well, we all know that person's a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
So go ahead and post it. But what it feels to me like is a very, it's chicken shit. Also, I think this idea of like, oh, people who haven't made up their minds yet, I think, I know I keep using Black Lives Matter just because I feel like it's the last sort of like, you know, sort of big social justice oriented
yes.
uproar there's been, like, that's comparable to this.
Yeah.
But like, in that situation, it's really hard for me to believe, like, okay, so you just came into this situation a total blank slate.
Yeah.
Like, in some ways, I do feel totally. That way. Yeah. At first, though, in the fog of everything on October 7th, I will say, you and I had a lot of conversations privately where yes. I was like, I'm seeing a lot of stuff in the immediate aftermath of this. And I'm talking, like, hours afterward.
Yeah,
day that of. Really, really were sickening to me.
I texted, like, my Jewish friends, and I was like, I'm so sorry for the way that people are behaving, and, like, this response that this is that there's some justification for what happened, that there is an excuse for that yeah. it is deserved, it's necessary,
yeah.
it's a byproduct of what, you know what I mean? I understand, but at the same time, it's like, these are real people. These
yes,
are
right.
people, they're in our communities, they're like, yeah. they're like, it's okay to just, like, let people mourn.
Something has really changed, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Something in the way that this conversation, because I think it represents these two divergent worldviews that are usually held by people who don't really talk to each other much.
Mm.
But it's the first time that we've been at, like, really at cross purposes with people like who we also think are, like, progressive or liberal.
Yeah.
It's like the first time we've, like, crossed swords with them, and we're like, oh shit. Like, I think yeah. it's the immediate reaction. I thought was really, I was disturbed by it. But then you posted something kind of to that effect.
Yeah.
And the response was swift.
Yeah.
And unforgiving, right?
Yeah. I was really frustrated because it some of the comments I got from folks were, oh, now I know what position you'd be during the Haitian Revolution, during the slave rebellion. It was so frustrating to me because I'm like, you are only, like, you're only saying that because we're here now, you know?
Right.
Because you're talking about it in retrospect. You're talking about a revolution in retrospect. I still, if it were, you know, I still would be like, I think people deserve to mourn the fact that, like, yeah, like, people went into people's homes and beheaded their children. Like, that happened in Haiti, you know? Like,
yeah.
And that's sad. That's really sad that happened. Am I on the side politically?
Yeah.
You know, no, of course not.
Even if you're saying, like, Jesus, it's sad that conditions necessitated that or brought people to that. Or, mm-hmm. like, it's sad that there was a system that wrenched people from their homes and enslaved them. And there's this, like, you know, systematic sort of system of torture that then, once that release valve was twisted, that these atrocities happen.
Right.
Like, that's all sad.
Yeah.
All of it is sad.
I think you hit it on the head, like, the day of when we were talking about it on October 7th, you said, if Hamas had come in and fucking blew up an IDF area, had done, you know, had murdered soldiers, like,
it would be a different conversation.
It would be a different conversation yeah. to be had.
Also, admittedly, I have not done a shitload of research into what's been going on, like, the past month or so. And it's a lot. But I consider myself to be, like, more informed than the average person on the issue, I would
yes.
say. I'm not an expert, but, like, I consider myself to be pretty up-to-date on it. And I was really involved with, like, pro-Palestinian activism when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
I took a History of the Middle East course, and through doing that, met some Lebanese American and Palestinian American people, and my family is part Lebanese, so I consider them to be really kindred spirits, and they sort of introduced me to, like, kind of like radical pro-Palestinian activism. I don't even know why I use the word radical. To
yeah.
me, it just felt radical.
Mm-hmm.
I had never really been exposed to that viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that, you know, growing up, I was very aware that my grandfather, who is Lebanese mm-hmm. on my mom's side, was super duper not only very anti-Israel, like, anti-Israel existing, anti-Zionist, he was straight up anti-Semitic. Like,
mm.
admitted it, said, like, Jews controlled all of the banks. Like, he didn't put any of his money into banks because he thought the Jews
Jesus.
Controlled the banks. They controlled the media. I was never close to my grandfather. We never really, straight up anti-Semitic. So
yeah.
it is not beyond my realm of understanding that those two worldviews can go hand in hand.
Mm.
I think they can.
Mm.
But I found, through these people that I became friends with in college, I remember we went to this coffee shop in Austin together, one of the first times that I really hung out with this group. One of them, it was this Palestinian-American woman named Tanya. And I remember she was sitting across from me at this coffee shop. We were outside smoking cigarettes. And we were talking about Israel. And I made some flippant, kind of like mildly anti-Semitic comment. Because I was like, oh, that's what y'all do, right? Like in my mind, it was a way for us to connect. Because that was how I had always heard anti-Zionism framed. Like, and I'm saying, I don't even know if I'm using that word. That's what I perceived it to be, right? Was like, if you are opposed to, or if you support Palestinian people, then it's normal that there's a little zest of anti-Semitism in it. And I remember she kind of froze and looked at me and was like, oh no, we don't do that. Like there's a huge difference between the religion and people who practice Judaism and people who are like ethnically Jewish and the state of Israel. Those are totally different things. Like, and it became clear to me, I was like, oh shit, I messed up. Like, so I came to understand like, oh, those two things don't go together at all. That's like a box of chocolates. You know, you never know what you're going to get.
Totally.
But one doesn't necessarily accompany the other. So I learned a lot about the issue, and I learned a lot about sort of like different perspectives that people have on the situation there. And again, not everything, because it's so goddamn complicated. But in the like immediate aftermath of this situation happening, I guess I wasn't, because I had uncoupled support for Palestinian people, even like the people that I knew in college who were activists were not like death to Israel people. They wouldn't say that. They were critiquing the foreign policy of an oppressive state.
Yes.
In the same way that they were critiquing the United States foreign policy.
Yes.
And this was also this was like a year after we invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. Right. So like it was high time. Like everybody was, and also by the way, like revenge foreign policy after an incident like that happens. But so for me, it was a really wake up call for me to like uncouple those feelings from each other because I didn't have anti-Semitic feelings or sentiments. I just thought, oh, that's what we do here, right? And no, it's not. They're not at all connected. So I think when you spoke out and in support of Palestinians and spoke out against the state sanctioned violence, the response was really shocking to me.
Yeah,
in that it was like legitimately, in doing this, you are engaging in anti-Semitism.
Yeah,
be careful, Jews. You might be dancing around it.
Yeah.
So I, for my relationship to this, I had, I was really, really against the invasion of Iraq. And for me, that was like a real like turning point for my like political orientation, my like the way that I wanted to engage like with social justice issues, with like with foreign policy, and like really seeing what a militarized state and the kind of destruction they can do and the kind of public support you can garner through media and through politics. And it really,
that's a great point,
really scared me. So for me, it really mobilized my sense of justice and my sense of like, oh, I live in a country that it does heinous things to people.
Yes, right.
And I think also like the images from Abu Ghraib and like really.
Yeah, part like, of your like political consciousness was shaped by that stuff.
Yes,
yeah.
Big time. And I remember I was touring with a poet, and somebody that worked for her was like, I'm really active in Free Palestine. And I was like, oh, I don't really actually know. I'm sorry. I don't know where Palestine is.
Yeah.
Like I didn't know. And she was like, oh, and she kind of told me a little bit about it. And I was like, wow, this sounds really bad. This is awful. Oh my God. And then I knew I was with somebody for a few years who had, you know, ties to Israel and who's Jewish. And I remember bringing it up to her and saying, oh, have you heard about this Free Palestine thing?
Have you heard about this business?
And she really shut it down. And she was like, we don't talk about that because it's like, it's so much more complicated than people think it is. And they want us dead. And I won't even like, don't even talk about. So I was like, oh, okay, this is so I.
Right.
Someone is just very misguided that I spoke to. They don't understand the importance of Israel and it needs to be there. So I just didn't research more about it because I was like, oh, well, this is what we believe then. So when all of this unfolded, I was like, oh, this is, I really need to do my own research because I have had these two experiences that really, like, I still don't know how I feel because I feel like in a couple instances, I feel like I've been told to feel a certain way.
Yes.
When I met you, you were very anti-Zionist. And so I was like, I just don't know if that's the right thing. You know?
I don't even know if that's the right, I'm trying to be conscious of my...
Oh, of language, yeah.
Yeah, because I don't know how I would care. I don't even know if that, like, if that has any... If that term has some connotations that I'm not aware of.
I see what you're saying.
But I will just say, yeah, fuck. See, I don't know how to... I'm not sure even how to describe it. I guess I would just say I came from a position of being really critical of Israel's treatment of Palestinian people.
And that's what I had figured was that. Yeah, can we pause?
So we just paused for a second because I was like, I don't know if that has any, if that word has some connotations that I'm not aware of. So I looked it up and I remembered there's a conversation about this. Mm-hmm. So the Anti-Defamation League says there is a relationship. People who are opposed to Zionism don't realize that that is an anti-Semitic position. But then Jewish Voices for Peace and some other like pro-Palestinian organizations say that that is an unfair critique.
Mm-hmm.
Like that you can be critical of Zionism or of the... I did the edgy atheist thing for like my teens and 20s, like almost entirely.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that because of some religious edict, people had a right to live in a place more than another group of people, I just totally rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And I really did think that religion was just such a scourge on the earth. And that like, that to me did not justify the right to force Palestinians from their homes and things like this. But yeah, I would say that's fair. I was like more critical of Zionism than certainly like who you've been in a relationship with before. Yeah.
And I think too, like, I think it's really indicative of something that I was like, please, can we pause? You know what I mean? Because I am.
Yeah. And I'm sorry because I jumped back into recording and I hope that you were.
No. This is good because I feel like this is part of the anxiety. This is part of the fear in talking about something and then not talking about it because we're scared.
Yes. Absolutely. Of course, it's a complicated issue. And I'm thinking about like your ex saying like, it's so complicated. It is complicated, but I wonder if. And I'm guilty of this too, that just saying like, well, it's complicated is this way of like, you know, forestalling conversation and not diving into the complexity of it
or not allowing critique.
Because on some level, like at its foundation, I think it's pretty simple. The United States has I'm really like invoking, I'm summoning my like 2003 through 2006 self right now. The United States has unquestioningly, right? Like it reminds me of when I was learning about the Vietnam War and there were all of these like rubber factories, like Goodyear and all these other like factories and U.S. corporations that manufacture tire. There were all these like rubber plants, like they cultivated all this rubber in like North Vietnam and that was like a big part of our involvement there is that we had like economic interest in the area and that we were protecting. That was part of our involvement. The United States never fucking gets involved in anything from out of the goodness of its heart.
Right.
They just don't. Like, it's just like, that's just not what we do. And right now I'm reading one of the two books I'm reading, which I'll talk about my obsessions. I'm reading the weirdest fucking pairing of books I've ever encountered in my whole life, but I love presidential biographies and presidential memoirs, and I'd never read George W. Bush's, which is called Decision Points. It is like laugh out loud. Like there have been parts where I've just stopped and I've just read it out loud to Mary because it's just jaw dropping. But I'm actually in the middle of the chapter about the invasion of Iraq right now. Mm. And the parallels are enormous. Mm. And the just sprinkled throughout this whole memoir are these mentions of how these terrorist states in the Middle East, like Iran and Iraq and, you know, no mention of Saudi Arabia, curiously, support Hamas. And these, you know, actions against that they would like fund Palestinian suicide bombers and stuff, and is using that as it's a foregone conclusion
in, like, the book.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Whoa. Throughout it is there's no question of, like, well, the United States lends all of its support to Israel unquestioningly. That's always been true, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So that's not a surprise to anybody. But so reading this has been really interesting because I remember when it was like after the United States tried to pass a UN resolution that essentially would get the global community behind us invading Iraq and deposing Saddam Hussein on the assumption that he had weapons of mass destruction, mm-hmm. or was creating weapons of mass destruction, which, mm-hmm. as we know now,
yes.
was never confirmed.
Right.
And he says, even in the biography, in the memoir, there's this line where he says, I get sick to my stomach thinking about the fact that we never found those WMD. And I'm like, well, that's a fucking weird thing to say, because, yeah. I'm like, you were sickened by the fact that you didn't, that they weren't there, because that would have been your justification. That would have been the justification. That's what he's upset about.
Right.
So anyway, and I remember where I was when George W. Bush came on TV and gave this press conference and said, I'm sure you remember this, it was like, mm-hmm. a speech from the Oval Office, mm-hmm. where he was like, everybody in Iraq, unless Saddam agrees to inspections, we're going to invade in 24 hours. And I remember at the end of that speech, he was like, and don't destroy your oil wells. Like, that oil wealth belongs to your people. Don't blow them up. And I remember just being like, looking around and being like, I can't believe he just fucking said that. Like, jeez. Because that's our only, that's a massive part of our reason for, that's why we don't invade Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Even though Saudi Arabia financed, that was Saudi money that financed the attacks on 9/11.
Yeah.
Anyway, taking a breath. All of this is to say, I think it would be foolish to forget that the United States generally behaves in such a way that we are out to protect our military and economic interests.
Mm-hmm.
The line that we hear is like that Israel is a sort of like bastion of Western democracy in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
and that without it, I don't know what could possibly be worse than what's already happening, you know.
Right.
But that that Israel is like this anchor to modernity, you know, to Western style liberal. Sorry, y'all. Georgie does not want us to have this conversation. Maybe, you know what? Georgie, I appreciate it. You're helping me through this. I understand where the critiques come from. I have heard the critiques. I think the history obviously matters. Like, context matters. Mm-hmm. It does matter, yes. how we got here.
Yeah.
This is a conversation, though, that is regarding, like you said earlier, like, this is something that is happening right now. It is a current. We have to be able to have a conversation about what is actually happening and what, yes. tensions are happening right this second.
Yes.
And what a future looks like that doesn't involve just removing one of the two groups of people altogether. Yes. Because I think we can agree neither one of those is a reasonable solution
100%.
To what's going on.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I feel like the conversation just gets mucked up. It is also just such a radioactive conversation. Like, mm-hmm. I have a colleague who was saying, she's like, I have taught all of the, because she was a middle and high school English teacher before, mm-hmm. becoming a professor. She's like, I have taught every anti-racist book under the sun that you can imagine. I have taught all kinds of controversial stuff, queer stuff, gender stuff. The most pushback I've ever gotten to a text that I included in one of my classes was a book written by a Palestinian person. And it's always been that way. So it's not new that this is a radioactive conversation. Mm-hmm. It's not
totally.
It's not new.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was part of my fear and being like, well, we can't talk about this. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know? But it honestly, because it was radioactive and because people were like, you really need to do your research. I was like, okay
I'll do
I'm
my
gonna
research.
Do my research.
And you did.
And
you dove in.
I dove in. I watched so many documentaries. I read a ton. I
Yeah, you were doing all night, pulling all-nighters. You were reading. You were
researching and reading a lot. Anything that someone linked to me and was like, have you read this? Have you heard about this? I'd be like, okay, let me see if that, like, changes my position. And a lot of times, like, I don't know, a lot, about 50% of the time, it would be like, okay, so this thing is more nuanced, or this thing that happened wasn't true, or, you know, like, I feel like it, I am so willing to hear all parts of an issue.
Yeah.
What is happening is pretty unequivocally, like, horrific.
Yes.
And I think what you're saying, and I really appreciate it, is that, like, we can't, of course, yes, context for where we are now, but we're here now, and we need to be forward thinking.
Yes, right.
What is the end goal?
Yes,
what's
right.
the end goal?
Yeah.
Because this idea that you're going to eradicate the infrastructure, if that's just...
Hamas, you mean?
If I'm going in with this mindset of being like, well, if the tunnels are underneath refugee camps, I guess we just have to blow them all up.
Right, right.
You know, like, even with that belief, like, insane belief system, what after?
You know, you said something, actually, like, and I know that I just sort of, it flies in the face of what I just said, but what this really reminds me of is, in the immediate aftermath, in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, there was a history professor at the university, a journalism professor, excuse me, at the University of Texas. I took a class with them, who is a pretty progressive, you know, what I think most people in the middle would consider to be a pretty radical, somebody who's pretty radically to the left.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a journalism professor, like a big, you know, liberal school. And he published this editorial on, like, September 12th, 2001 in, I think, the Houston Chronicle. And he basically was like, well, yeah, this makes sense. Like what happened makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, if you look at our foreign policy decisions over the past 50 years or so, I think this is a totally unsurprising. Yes, it sucks. Yes, it's tragic. But our foreign policy decisions just, we lit the fuse a long time ago for this to happen, and it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a deluge of, and of course, I mean, it was a bold decision to publish that immediately after. Of course it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was a deluge of, like, death threats, and he had to, like, leave his office for, like, weeks at a time. And this was, like, pre, you know, super, super ubiquitous email. So people were sending, like, physical death threats and letters. And I mean, it calls for his resignation and for the president to dismiss him, all this kind of stuff. And now that seems kind of tame, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're like, well, yeah, of course that happened. But I do think that there just wasn't as much space for people to publicly say that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of people thought that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but you couldn't say that, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can't say that while people are mourning and 2,000 Americans just were just slaughtered in cold blood and while they were going to work and shit. Like, you can't openly say, like, yeah, we had it coming.
Yeah.
But a lot of people thought that. And a lot of people who were very critical of the United States foreign policy. Remember Michael Moore's movie, Fahrenheit 9/11?
Mm-hmm.
That was also, I mean, like, that to me is exactly the same. There are so many parallels to the response to what happened on October 7th.
Yes.
It doesn't hurt anyone to try to understand the conditions that led to something happening. People do really horrific things when they feel hopeless, when they are pushed to the brink, when they have no options,
mm-hmm.
when they've been radicalized. Because in order to be radicalized, you have to be in an environment, in a situation, and lacking resources and lacking options enough to be radicalized.
Yes.
You couldn't radicalize, like, people who Park Avenue in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not going to radicalize people who have options and who don't have a reason to... who aren't in a position to be like, yeah, you know what? Fuck it. Like, we have, there's nothing else we can do. This is survival.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean is just, like, it doesn't, like, diminish the honoring of the dead or the suffering to say, like, holy shit, it sucks that we got to where we are.
Mm-hmm.
It sucks that the conditions have gotten us to where we are. But rather than getting lost in the muck of trying to relitigate that, because in public conversation, I mean, I don't know how much that helps. I think you have to be able to say, like, okay, shit, that's what the conditions were like. Okay, mm-hmm. this happened. How do we deal with it going forward? How do we, let's listen now. Like with Hamas, tell me if I don't know if I'm wrong about this. And also, I just don't want to pop off at the mouth about shit I don't know anything about. But based on what I've read, I think Hamas is an organization that, like, openly doesn't have a problem inflicting, like, civilian casualties.
Yeah. I mean, that's the evidence of, like, we're going to do this again. We will absolutely do this again.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's fair to be like, we live next to a place where people want us dead.
Yes.
And I think also when this all initially happened, I was like, well, if Hamas is a terrorist group, then they weren't, like, then they've just totally taken control and there's no way they were, like, politically elected. And then I was like, oh, they were politically elected. they were elected to be in charge of Gaza, right?
When I'll hear people say, and I remember thinking this after 9/11 too, like, the hijackers were evil. Remember, Bush was obsessed mm-hmm. with that term evil, right? Mm-hmm. That the world is good, there are good people, and there are evil people who hate your freedom and want you dead. Mm-hmm. And Hamas is evil, and they're evil people, and they want you dead. I think that is such a facile, childlike way of understanding it. Because mm-hmm. I just don't think anytime you find yourself saying an entire group of people is evil, mm-hmm. you've lost the plot. Like, instead, if you find people acting horrifically, right? Like, what's that old line? Like, ordinary people do fucked up things when fucked up things become ordinary. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to at least be able to have a conversation about what conditions are breeding extremism. Mm-hmm. I think, like,
yeah.
It's absolutely necessary. Like,
totally.
People who mourn their dead, people who love their families, people who love their children and don't want to hurt people.
Yeah.
How did we get to this?
Totally. Yeah.
How did we get to October 7th?
I don't think it would be beyond the pale to be like, how did Al-Qaeda form? How did Hezbollah form?
Yeah.
How did all of these other terrorist groups form? And, like, is there something that, like, maybe could have prevented it? Is there something that happened along the way that maybe the government that of the place that I live in was instrumental to?
Yes.
You know?
And I can hear the echoes of people saying, like, oh, okay, then should we try to sympathize or empathize? Because, I mean, I'm also the person who, after the election of Trump, when people are like, we haven't been listening to the white working class, the neglected white working class, we weren't listening. And of course I was like, shut up. Like, you know, I'm like, yeah, what is there to know? So I know I'm being a little bit hypocritical, but I think this is a little bit different because there is something there to understand. Yes, there is. Mm-hmm. If you have a whole swath of people who, like, they hear Trump's racist shit and they're like, yeah, that's it. You're saying stuff that I've said in my living room, I've never said out loud before, and more than half the country is voting for you. Yes, you. In order to address that, you have to understand it. Of course, mm-hmm. you have to. It doesn't mean that you're excusing it or, you know, like, imagine if we were all, if, like, no historians ever made an attempt to understand how the Third Reich came to power.
Yeah.
Or, like, how anti-Semitism came to be in the first place. Right. Like, you know, which is its own long storied history. Like, you have to be able to understand that. I'm realizing, though, I am saying simultaneously, let's not get bogged down in the history, but also let's try to understand the history. I think what I'm saying is, like, expressing the conditions that breed violence and extremism, that does not preclude mourning the dead or condemning violence. I don't think it justifies violence to say, you know, like, that Israel has developed sort of a military kind of apartheid state, right? Like,
yes.
I don't think that that's necessarily...
Well, no, because for me, it was the same thing on October 7th when Hamas went in and, like, murdered a whole bunch of Israeli citizens. We can start trying to understand and piecing it together, but, like, that any sympathy that could have been there that was like, okay, yeah, let's understand all of the, I don't know. For me, it flipped so quickly with the knee-jerk reaction of, like, okay, let's fucking go nuclear.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah. The worst thing that could happen, in my opinion, because I believe in, like, you know, like, expression of ideas to a fault. Like, I think that you should be able to discuss, I really, really do. But, like, I was apprehensive about having this conversation mm-hmm. because I would not be the first person who would, you know, like face like professional consequences for saying something that might be offensive, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but it's not that I'm like trying to say something that's not offensive. I'm really not. I have seen and I have witnessed and I have known, like, do I think, for example, my grandfather, who was actually opposed to the existence of Israel and who was actually anti-Semitic, it doesn't do me any good to just say, well, my grandfather's just an asshole. Like, that to me is not a satisfactory answer. Mm. When I try to think, though, like, okay, where did my grandfather get these ideas? Like, where did he really come to believe wrongly? I mean, truly, because I think that's just an unsustainable, ridiculous position. Mm-hmm. Like, this idea of there being some global Zionist, you know, conspiracy is wingnut. That's batty. That's not grounded in reality. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't do me anybody any good for me to like dismiss it offhand. It was helpful for me to like understand where that was sort of coming from. I don't know. I don't really even know what I'm saying.
I know exactly what you're saying. I feel like it's really important. I guess what I'm trying to say too when I'm talking about, can we not talk about context when we're talking about mourning or expressing like, hey, this thing that's happening, it's bad. You know, like, can we stop doing that? I'm going to call for the bad thing to stop.
Right.
There's no room for context in that, in these calls to action, in my opinion. I don't think that it's helpful to couch everything and have all of these caveats of, like, October 7th was bad, it was really bad, but also can we please, you know, calling for a ceasefire. Yeah. Like, I think what happens is, like,
I'm
hearing myself, but...
No, you're right. I mean, and I think I have a colleague who has really been inspiring me. He spoke to a student who was part of a Muslim students organization on campus, and they wanted to have like what seemed to be like a pretty generic like rally for peace. It wasn't even like a call for a ceasefire explicitly. It was just like, can we have a rally like in support of peace? It wasn't even like in support of Palestinian lives or pro-Palestine explicitly. And that somebody on campus advised them against doing that. Like, that they were like, let's not politicize this. Like, let's maybe not. Mm. And for me, first of all, on a college campus, that drives me nuts. I can't stand the thought of that. Because, like, a college campus should be the place where those kind of conversations should happen. Right. I really do believe that. And I know that I am not joined by a lot of my colleagues in believing that. I think air out all of that shit, because I think that... obviously with certain limitations. But anyway, I'm in favor of free speech on campus. Yeah. And I know that I am not joined in that opinion always by people. But it still shocked me.
Yeah.
And it shocked me not just because I don't know if it had been an explicitly pro this or pro that rally, if it would have been acknowledged. There seems to be like pretty convincing kind of evidence that I've noticed that it seems like coverage of specifically supportive of Palestine is being like shadow banned.
Yeah.
Especially pro-Palestinian.
Yes.
And like there was one incident that I thought was really telling in which Meta acknowledged like, oh, oops, we were lumping in like pro-Palestinian posts in Arabic as like terrorism. We were labeling it as terrorism.
Yeah.
Oops, it was like a translation error, you know? And so I do think that that's happening. And I think there seems to be a trend in that kind of direction that I do think is troubling.
Yeah.
And I think that's also how a lot of conspiracy theories sort of start taking root is because people feel as if like, well, one side of this is really getting broadcast and the other isn't. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It really feels like our social media fuckery has gotten us to the point where like that group of people, like people who are really pro-Israel, and I hate even dividing it into these camps, it's just so stupid, but like people who are more pro-Israel in this situation feel like their side is being censored and people I think that we have officially ensconced ourselves so effectively that I don't really even know what's happening.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I hear you. I don't know. Yeah, because when I open my feed, I'm like, I feel like I'm getting a good mix of everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's just my social media feed. I'm not really watching a lot of terrestrial news. I know a lot of people are getting their news from TikTok. I'm not really on, you know what I mean?
So and that there are a lot of people who are like on the ground too.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there are a lot of like Palestinian people and people in, you know, Israeli people who are, you know, and so I think probably what's happening is because of, you know, like Mark, the wizardry of Mark Zuckerberg, we're probably all just getting stuff that is like sort of intensifying our own perspective on this issue. But see, I don't know. I don't know. God damn it.
But okay, so I'm now remembering why I said the thing about context. It's because I think context should really inform your position on an issue. Context should inform your greater position on an issue. But I don't think context has to inform every position on every single social media post.
Right. Yes. You know? Yeah, yeah.
Like, I think that that is what is, that's what's troubling to me, is that people feel like they have to provide context for every single thing they say.
Right.
And I don't think that that's fair.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I think people are scared to speak in support of Palestine or Palestinians or say ceasefire, is because they feel, and they've been pressured to feel, that they have to couch it and make all of these little caveats to make sure it's,
right,
it's in this thing that's acceptable.
Right, yes.
And I think that that's why people are quiet.
Yeah.
And so in that way, I understand what Spires is saying, but I also think that, to me, that comes from one side. Like, I have, that's what I've noticed.
It is a side. Also, it's it is a side to say, I'm choosing not to say anything, right? Like, what's the old thing about you can't be neutral on a moving train? But I get it, because, and I feel myself like equivocating right now. I feel myself doing it, but I think, like, and I can understand, I'm thinking about the way that, like, mainstream politicians speak about this issue, right? Even when there are politicians who go into sort of the Democratic establishment being more critical of Israel, once they get there, it really changes. And the support becomes really unequivocal. And I think that that also sort of, like, deepens this, like, really deeply entrenched sort of distrust of politics and of politicians. Because, like you said, I think they are seeing something that, on based on what they're seeing, like, on TikTok, they're like, I know that's not true. Like, I know what you're saying about everybody in Palestine being a terrorist is not true. I've seen it with my own eyes. Like, I've seen the suffering with my own eyes, right? Or vice versa. Like, I've seen on TikTok that it is true and that everybody is, you know, I don't know. I'm not even sure exactly where I was going with that, but...
No, I mean, I think I, what the other thing that I heard was, you know, Palestinians would want you dead, right? You know that they don't want gay people there, you know? And I'm like, that's not a prerequisite for caring about humanity. The other thing I think that people are missing is, when we're talking about a genocide, it's not just flagrant bombing. It's not just indiscriminate bombing or bombing of refugee camps and hospitals and schools. It's this restriction of food and water and resources.
Yeah.
There is nowhere for them to go.
To go, yeah.
And
you're talking about millions of people.
Yes, for over a month now. For how long has it been? Oh, my God, for so long
it's
now.
It's been almost 2 months.
Jesus Christ. For so long that, like, this... I feel like there's no defense of that. Like, I feel like there's nothing you can say that would be like, well, Hamas could use the water. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
No,
and this feeling too of, like, don't show me your suffering, because I reject that. Because by showing me your suffering, you're saying that all of this suffering and the generations of suffering don't matter. Like, it just doesn't.
Totally.
That's just not how we achieve a resolution.
Yeah.
You know, that's not how you, like, achieve humanity.
Yeah.
Your humanity should not be contextual, right?
Yeah.
It's an immediate thing. You're talking about the lived experiences of real human beings, right?
Totally. I mean, I think that's when I started to feel critical of all this. I was like, well, who am I? You know, I'm fucking, like, we're living on Wampanoag land. You know what I mean? Like, I grew up on Duwamish land.
Yeah.
I am a product of a genocide. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It feels like I can't untangle myself from America and America as a militarized state. But I would also say that I'm here now I'm here right. now. And yeah. I don't, like, I'm going to do the best that I can. Right. I'm here now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel that for Israelis, and I feel that for, like, everybody's here now. So yes. what do yeah. we do now?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's this.
But I think what happens, too, is this, I have this feeling of, like, I am still critical of everything the U.S. does. Like, this isn't, it's not just coming from I'm not just suddenly politically active because right. it's Israel. Like, I've been this way my whole life.
Right.
You know? Yeah, like, yeah. I think that might be some of this knee-jerk reaction that's happening from maybe people who otherwise haven't been right. politically active.
Yeah.
That I think there are some people who are supporters of Israel
yeah.
are like, so now you're just speaking up.
Yeah.
Isn't there a coincidence there?
It's also like something has shifted in the way, that's just how it feels to me, is like, because this has been 5 decades old at this point, right? Or like, you know, the since the state of Israel has been established anyway in like the 50s. This is a, what?
7 decades.
Oh shit! Yeah, you're right.
Isn't it funny? I think we're in 2002. 2003. Yeah.
But like, something feels, and I can't quite put a finger on it, to the extent that like I don't even really know why I'm saying this out loud, except that like something feels different about the response this time around, mm-hmm. and the way that the conversation is happening. And I think the conversation is happening in the wake of. It's not really, it's like, so we did the cancel culture thing, and then we decided, okay, we're not doing the cancel culture thing, and so then it's like, okay, but we're all on the side of social justice, right? But then, like, in this situation, we don't know what social justice really is. Mm. We don't really know what it means to do that right now, right? Mm. There has been, this is another thing. I was thinking about, like, public, because I wonder what public opinion would say about, like, support for Israel. I imagine it's overwhelmingly pro-Israel, like, public opinion.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that I'm not, I say this as a student of education, right? As somebody who's interested in education. People in the wake of the Holocaust, in the decades after the Holocaust, there was a really concerted, really focused effort on behalf of activists, mostly Jewish activists, to make sure that the Holocaust loomed appropriately large in the American imagination. Mm-hmm. Like, never again. Never again. Mm-hmm. And that people need to know what the fuck happened.
Yeah.
And there was a clear relationship with the United States, too. We saw the horrors up close. There were, like, you know, generations. There were military servicemen in World War II who saw the horrors of the Holocaust up close, right? And didn't forget that. And Jews who came to the United States after the Holocaust, who escaped the, you know, Nazi Germany. And so there was a really concerted, like, decades of an activist effort to make sure that Holocaust education was a prominent part of the American curriculum. Mm-hmm. I certainly benefited from that.
Yeah, same.
I mean, I remember reading The Giver mm-hmm. and, shit, I'm going to forget. Like, we read The Diary of Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. There was some other book. I can't remember what. And I went to an Episcopal school. Mm-hmm. And yet, I felt like we had a day in class where, it was a week where we all presented individual projects that were Holocaust related. There was a class just about the Holocaust offered in my public high school in South Texas. So that was a concerted effort. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not critiquing that yeah. at all. In fact, like, I think there was no equivalent of that. There's no equivalent of that in American culture, or like, you know, there was a spate of like books and films. I'm thinking about like Schindler's List mm-hmm. and, you know, all other films that have like, it was kept in the American imagination mm-hmm. really effectively yeah. for good fucking reason.
Yeah, totally.
In a way that I don't know that anything relating to Palestinian displacement or suffering hasn't been.
Oh, I had there no have idea. Been
absolute atrocities committed in that region without question. Saying one does not invalidate the other, mm-hmm. but like even the suffering of like Native American people in this country, or, you know, the fact that, or like, you know, I didn't learn about like Japanese internment camps, or, you know, I didn't even really fully learn about like Jim Crow until I found out about it on my own.
Right. Same.
So like, to me, that just means like, we need to really step up our efforts, because to me, that is also like that edge that we just don't have. A lot of people, I think, are operating without really a full picture. I don't think I'm saying, like, people are supportive of Israel because of the Holocaust. I don't mean that. I just mean, like, God, I think that there's the things that you can learn and how you can expand your humanity by reading stories and connecting with it and, like, really getting a full picture of it.
Totally.
I think would really sort of, like, expand our consciousness around the issue and have an appreciation for the, like, wide range of human experiences, you know, I mean, that happened there, but it can't happen if it's like, there's a story about a Palestinian person and it's like, what are you doing? Get that out of my school. You're anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
That can't be that.
Yeah.
That can't be how we understand each other.
Yeah.
Right.
I completely agree.
And I think it is possible to be full-throated in your criticism of the extent to which Israel is, like, inflicting suffering on people. It is impossible to do that and to say, like, of course, anti-Semitism is a pernicious global force that has caused just millions of deaths and causes just unspoken suffering around the world. Of course it is.
Yeah.
Those things are not, you can hold both of those thoughts in your brain at the same time.
Absolutely. You have to.
You must.
Like the world demands it. And and humanity demands that.
Yes. Yeah.
Care of all people demands that you hold both of those things.
Exactly. And there's one example, like, this is kind of, you know, I'm going to put, like, a warning in the show notes and everything, but, like, I'll say just as, like, a trigger warning. So I'm going to talk about something kind of gruesome here just for a minute. Something that's emblematic to me of the fact that there's a problem with how we're talking about stuff and how we're covering stuff is this story that came out after October 7th. There was a story circulating that members of Hamas had beheaded a bunch of babies. Joe Biden even went so far as to say that he had seen pictures of it. It turns out there weren't any. Like, there was not some mass beheading of babies. The fact that I saw on social media a debate about this where it was like people who are on one side saying, that's not true, you're full of shit, and the other side being like, it has to be true. Yes, it is. Yes, it is true. Like, that to me was, like, representative of how fucked this is. Mm-hmm. Is that, like, our dedication to, like, we in that moment didn't have the humility to understand what was happening.
Yes. I feel like that argument still happens online and it makes my skin crawl.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Like, I don't care. I don't care. I'm not going to be like, I'm right about this thing and you're wrong about this thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I think it's not something to go in the weeds about.
Right. Right. And it's so, like, you don't have to, there's enough awful shit going on. There's no need to keep sort of returning to this one well of horror. Like, it seems to me like, and I don't have the answers to this. Like, I'm just an observer. I have no idea. And, like, I don't know to the extent to which, like, tying this back in with the manic episodes, like, I don't even trust my brain to engage with it. So I've just, like, gotten back into sports gambling and have totally shut it off. Right. Like, it's not an accident that it has been, like, virtually, because as you've said, like, you're like, I used to have fun going on Instagram, and now, not to say, like, oh, man, why do people have to be dying all over the world? My feed's not fun anymore. Like, not like that, but, like, now it's just horror after horror.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm sticking my head in the sand. I admit it. Like, I am. So I'm not an expert on all this. I have no idea what the answer is. I have no idea. Yeah. Like, I just don't know.
No, I think there's humility in that to be like, I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's okay for things to be just really somber and there to be, there's a lot happening in the Congo. There's a lot happening in Sudan. Like, there's, like, I was watching these stories about cobalt mining that it was just, like, devastating. And there's just so many parts of the world when you really examine and get out of your fucking
and there's
little spot and you're just like, hate that. I hate that all of this is happening and I want to fix all of it. Yeah. And I don't know how.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think, like, and you can't, and it feels to me to say, I mean, you remember this happened too, like in the wake of, during the summer of 2020 with the, mm-hmm. with Black Lives Matter, it was like, I don't know what to do. I feel like I'm not doing enough. Right. Mm-hmm. And for some people, I think they end up like this Spires person who's mm-hmm. like, well, it's just not fair that I just don't want to say anything. But here I am saying something about how I don't want to say anything. Like, you know, it's like, I don't know if saying anything makes a difference, but I do know, I think one thing that really needs to be dismantled is this notion that it needs to be okay to criticize United States foreign policy.
Yes.
And that's really what is going on here, I think. Because there's, like, seeing Rashida Tlaib not being allowed, like, being censored by Democrats for speaking in support of Palestine is representative of a problem.
Yeah.
It's not good that we have so conflated critique of foreign policy, because this is, like, Patriot Act shit. This is what happened after 9/11, remember? Where it was, mm-hmm. like, if you can't say anything critical of our foreign policy, or you're, like, unpatriotic. This is, like, Red Scare shit.
Yeah.
Like, I think that that's one thing that, like, actually sharing stuff and speaking out and sharing memes and stuff does matter, because we need to normalize expanding the what constitutes acceptable conversation in this area. Mm. It can't just be that if you speak out, you're anti-Semitic and you need to shut the fuck up. That can't be true. Totally. And it also can't be true that if you mourn civilians who are killed in terrorist attacks by Hamas, that you are a fascist who's supporting genocide, who's supporting, you know, the elimination of Israel. Like, you can't, that can't be, this can't, we have to, we, this can't be the case.
Yeah.
Or excuse me, sorry. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
100%.
And, I think we need to, that if anything good will come of this, like, I think a lot of fucking good came of, and it's not just, you know, like, Hershey releasing a statement saying Black Lives Matter. I think a lot of legitimate good came out of what fucking happened and what we contended with in the wake of George Floyd's murder. Mm-hmm. I think that was necessary. That was a necessary thing for us to go through as a country. Have we made progress because of it? I don't know. But it was that's a necessary gauntlet, like, for us to have gone through, I think. Mm-hmm. This is, too. Mm-hmm. And I think that if there is something to be gleaned from it, I think that it's, like, it's that, like, you know, shadow banning and, like, blocking on social media and stuff notwithstanding, it needs to be acceptable to have a conversation about what the future looks like for Palestinian people, and that it is okay to advocate for Palestinian people.
Yeah.
We cannot make that an unacceptable conversation to have. Yes. Like, the messages that you got after sharing, like, I shared, like, a friend of mine is doing this, like, you can buy eSIM cards for people in Palestine, and I shared it, and I got some message that it was anti-Semitic. And, like, you got a message about when you shared something about the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund.
It's been constant. Like, I don't want to, it's so hard, because it's like, I don't want this to silence me. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want this to, I know my heart. I know what I mean. I know what I feel. I know what is right. But it's really difficult to have people, like, you know, I really loved you, and but what you're saying is anti-Semitic, and I don't feel safe with you. I don't feel safe with your music anymore. It's really difficult. So, of course, I understand when people are like, I don't want to say anything, because you don't want to hurt people. You don't want to upset other people's feelings. But I have to just stay true to my heart and know that being critical of a militarized state enacting harm, suffering, needlessly, without thinking about the future, with restricting aid in a way that if it smells like genocide, if it talks like genocide, it's genocide. Like, it's happening right now. And I have to accept that as a consequence, that there are some people that are maybe just too deep in their own understanding and their own relationship and experience to this issue that they just can't see it. And I have to just accept that.
I'm imagining, like, you know, speaking of like, education about this issue. Like, I mean, I'm imagining if I grew up and had, and were raised Jewish and had generational trauma mm-hmm. around, you know, had like relatives who had died in the Holocaust or who had fled Nazi Germany or had been victims of anti-Semitic hate crimes in the United States and had heard this message, like, this happened once before, we have to be vigilant so that it doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
Because Jews have been castigated and cast out and you know, been victims of violence for thousands of years. I mean, anti-Semitism is a very old phenomenon. It's real. It's a very real, very old phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it's based in, a lot of it is based in absolute fiction, warping of facts. And yeah. It's a mind virus, the same yes. way that racism is.
Yes.
If I had that generational trauma, of fucking course, I can imagine I would feel differently about this.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Just the same, like, I feel like I had an opportunity to buy into whatever trauma my grandfather had, mm-hmm. and I didn't do that. I just really committed myself to not doing that. Like, yeah. because I learned about anti-Semitism, how anti-Semitism sort of took root in medieval Europe, and, like, I learned about this stuff, and then once you learn about it, you can't think that way anymore, right?
Yeah.
What matters is, like, that there is, like, immediate human suffering right now, and that, yes, as an American citizen, you absolutely have not only a right, but a civic responsibility to respond to what is being done in your name.
Yeah.
And this is being done in our name.
Yeah.
It is. With our financial support, with our political support.
You're talking about
the U.S.? Yes.
Yeah.
And it is creating an environment in which opposition to that is actually being silenced. And in the form of Rashida Tlaib, you're actually saying it as the only Palestinian American member of Congress. Right. That should scare you.
Yeah.
It should scare you as somebody who supports democracy. Like, I think it's good to learn and listen to people's voices and be critical. Like, I think you owe it to yourself as, like, a taxpaying citizen of this country to understand what is being done in your name. And if you, you know, if like the idea of, you know, like the number of civilians that were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm reading this book right now. George W. Bush believes down to his bones that Iraq and Afghanistan needed to be liberated from these terrorist forces that had dug their way into those countries, and that the United States was going to continue to be at risk if they were not addressed via hundreds of thousands of civilian casualties being an acceptable collateral. Yes. I don't know of anybody that I agree with politically, anybody that, even people I know who don't agree with me on much, who I'd be like, what do you think about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan? Was that worth it? Like, nobody fucking thinks that. Like, of course not, right? Like, we all know better now. We all look at that and we're like, what were we thinking?
Yeah.
Like, how did we let ourselves get whipped up into this froth of hysteria that we got involved in that for, like, we were in Afghanistan for, like, 15 years?
Yeah.
Untold, and American lives being lost, too. Like, yes, you can be critical of that. And by the way, I was told during that time that I could not be critical of that at the time because it was unpatriotic.
Right, totally.
Now, that seems insane in hindsight, so let's not do the same thing now.
Yeah.
Where we're like, this is unquestioningly the right thing to do because you have on this side, you have light and goodness and democracy. On that side, you have terrorism. Is that really what you want? You want to support the terrorists? Like, don't let somebody elbow you into that facile a conversation about this. You know?
Yeah.
You owe it to yourself to really interrogate that.
Yeah.
But you also owe it to yourself to be, I think, a decent human being and extend humanity and be humble to not really, to extending humility and when you don't know what's going on. It's okay to say you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have to tell a lot of our teachers in training that. I'm like, tell your students. They will respect you more if you say you don't know than if you make something up.
Yeah.
Like, just say you don't know. It's okay not to know.
Yeah.
I've tried to get more used to doing that too. Like, I've said it 100 times on this podcast. I don't fucking know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that you have to humble yourself, I think, too, to, like, be humane and let that in.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to listen to anything you have to say.
Yeah.
If you start with, well, what about that? Like, you know, like, nobody wants to hear that. And I think it just you have really modeled, I think, such a beautiful way of engaging with this issue that, like, if you're being told simultaneously that you are on one side or the other, that's probably a sign that, like, you're engaging in it somewhat fairly.
Yeah.
Like, I just think that what you've done has really been, like, modeling, like, patience and humility and humanity and, like, calling, you know, like, calling balls and strikes morally as you see them, mm-hmm. Without getting fixed into one viewpoint so much that you can't listen to other people.
Yeah. I think, too, it's really fair to look at this issue and then think about the real life consequences of people that live in America or that are your friends who are Jewish, who are Muslim, and really say they're experiencing actual consequences to the discourse.
Yeah.
That there are people that are like, I'm not going to wear my yarmulke out, or I normally yeah. would.
Yep.
There are people who are like, I'm afraid to wear my hijab out. Like, yeah. I think that our sensitivity to that needs to be accounted for as well.
Absolutely.
And I wish it wasn't so polarizing to be like, oh, this is bad, that this is happening, that people are scared, this is bad.
Yep.
But I think that only comes from this very, like, let's not even talk about context or nuance at any point. You know?
Yeah.
Like, that's what happens, is that, like, people are just fucking scared.
Yeah.
I don't
yeah.
want anyone to be scared.
Yeah, it's true. Even, like, you know, I think this is also the issue about which I've had the hardest time finding information.
Mm.
I'm finding it very difficult to find information about it because I'm questioning everything I see.
Right, right.
Like, it's really difficult to find coverage of it. Like, it's really, and I don't know. I mean, I just don't want to lose sight of my own. Like, my nightmare is realizing that I'm living in a bubble.
Yeah.
And that I'm not letting other points of view in. Like, that's my nightmare, is that, like, I'm on the wrong side of everything. And I just don't know it because I'm trapped in the bell jar, you know? Like, that's my nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
And so I've really tried to, you know, I've tried to look at this, like, when I was looking for, like, anti-Zionism, like, I want to read what the ADL has to say about it. I understand that there are people who have been critical of the ADL. I understand that there are people who have been critical of Jewish Voices for Peace. This is also a great example of why I think media literacy is so difficult, because it shouldn't be, well, that I can dismiss this out of hand because of what it says and I don't agree with it, or like, oh, okay, that's the organization it came from, well, I can just ignore it.
Mm.
But, like, being able to know when you can say, like, okay, my gut is telling me I don't want to read this because it's not, I don't agree with it, but if they're making a good faith effort to, like, communicate with me, I'm going to see what they have to say, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Anyway.
Totally.
So, do you think we did that topic justice?
I hope so. I think so.
I hope so. We've gone back and forth on talking about this, like, since it happened.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, since October 7th. Like,
yeah.
Also, that's the thing, too, is, like, it's so absurd to say, like, oh, all of this started on October 7th. No, that was just when the current conversation about it started. But that was, like, an in media race or whatever. Like, that, everything was already fucking happening.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but things have definitely changed since then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway.
There was a comment. I don't remember where I screenshotted this comment or where it came from, but I found it in my phone and I was like, I liked this comment.
Yeah, bring us home with it.
Unfortunately, I don't know who said it. I'm sorry, but I just really liked, it.
Please.
They said, it's getting really tired for people to continuously use this accusation as a cudgel. So this is in response. I think this might have been, maybe, I can't remember when someone said it was anti-Semitic for support of Palestine. To use this accusation as a cudgel when they take issues with someone's pro-Palestine stance. It's intellectually lazy, it's cruel, and more often than not, it's baseless. My issue is with Netanyahu, Herzi Halevi, Isaac Herzog, and the IDF personnel, Israeli police, and settlers that are constantly vocalizing incredibly dehumanizing things about Palestinians, conflating them with Hamas, violently forcing people out of their homes and off their land under the threat of death, abusing and silencing anti-Zionist Israeli Jews, keeping 10,000 Palestinians as hostages under administrative detention without charge or trial, setting up illegal settlements on Palestinian land, policing civilian life via military occupation, every so often cutting off access to food, water, and electricity just to keep people in line, mm-hmm. instigating violence and then blaming it on Palestinians, creating policies, quoting Bible verses about Amalek as a call to genocide, and leveling Gaza and murdering over 10,000 civilians, 70% of which are women and children under the guise of defense.
Mm, yeah.
And it just, when I read it, I was like, that's exactly how I feel.
That you're talking, because you're talking about actions and consequences and policies in, yes. In the moment.
Yes.
Like that your problem is not with, because it's the, and it can't be like, we are cutting off access to Palestinian food and water. And then you're like, and people are like, oh, well, you don't think Israel has a right to exist? Why yeah. not? And, you know, like yeah. that's, yeah. but yeah, you know, I was nervous about having this conversation. Yeah.
I'm thinking, so I was in LA like 2 weeks ago. And I did a performance at a Seventh-day Adventist church. I was asked to perform there. And I was like, I don't know if I know much about the Seventh-day Adventist church. I thought they would be affirming if they had invited me. But as a religion, they are not affirming. And my experience there was... Initially, I was just really, I was like, what the hell? Like, I was talking to these people and I was just like, oh my God, this is not an officially sanctioned Seventh-day Adventist thing. Like,
it was like an offshoot. Yeah, they went rogue.
Yeah, it was like something they do for you know, the queer Seventh-day Adventists. And they've been doing it for 44 years.
Is it like people who are currently Seventh-day Adventists?
Yes.
Okay, got it. So it's not like ex-Seventh-day Adventists.
Yeah,
okay.
No. It's people who are currently practicing. And this was the first year that they had ever been allowed in a church.
Damn.
After 44 years of wow. gathering. And I had this feeling while I was in, you know, I was in kind of a back room to myself just doing some work after I had met some people. And I was like... Why are you here? Like, yeah. Why are you? Don't you know there are affirming churches and denominations you can go to? Like, why stay?
Yeah.
In this place when, like,
get out of here.
They don't want you. They don't want you here. Like this is your. Why are you just inflicting harm on yourself? And it was like I saw this room full of people that were like, "Please accept us. Yeah. Someday they'll accept us." And I just felt like my 17-year-old self that was like,
"Just get out." Yeah. Fuck yeah. It. Yeah.
And. After my full day with everybody, it's really started occurring to me where I was like, that's not why people have faith. Yeah. That's not why people are, you know, are religious. It's not because it's necessarily easy. It's just because it's what they believe.
Right, yeah.
And they're also staying there for the other queer people that feel unsafe yeah. or trapped.
Who yeah, yeah.
And they are there to be a bridge. And I think we need people like that. And so when I think about these larger issues and when, you know, when I see people putting themselves sort of on the front lines of it and being like, why are you doing this? You don't have to do that.
Yeah.
You don't have to hurt yourself or like, you know, whatever yeah. it is. And it's like they're not doing that, you know, because it feels good. Like,
yeah.
I'm not staying aware of what's happening in Palestine because it feels good. It's important to do because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I want to be a voice of reason and on the voice and the side of humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, the it's something that, for better or worse, like, you are, you know, like, as an American citizen, you're indirectly involved in.
Mm-hmm.
But I really do think, like, your elected officials have a position on this yeah. issue. The position they have on this issue matters.
Yeah.
Like, we helped to create this.
Yeah.
And we have a responsibility to be attentive to it in that yeah. way, you know?
Absolutely.
And to hold people accountable for their behavior.
Right.
Right? And their policies.
Yeah.
Okay. Well...
Thank you for
Fiend.
Yeah, thank you for hanging with us and
yeah. Do you want to talk about obsessions?
Yeah. What are you obsessed with?
My first obsession, I alluded this to this during our discussion, but I am back. I'm big time back on the gambling train. Before I met Mary, I and up until the very beginning of our relationship, I very much enjoyed gambling on sports. Usually on these, like really, you know, sports gambling was illegal. So these, like, shady, like, off, out of the country bookie sites that would take, like, 9 million years to get paid. And, like, they'd never give you enough money. And they're just all scams. Well, now that I've gotten back into it, I am in the world of legalized gambling on sports in most states and in Massachusetts. And I've been having an absolute blast with it. And, yeah, it's fun, but also I feel that I'm getting more gray hair because I am, you know, betting on, like, darts matches that are happening in the middle of the night. Anyway, so that's my number one obsession.
Well, I would love to have, because I feel like this is actually a big topic, because, like, I think when we bring this up, because I feel like we're not, because I'm like, okay, I think you should bet on this guy, because like, I'm in on it too. And I think what's great about it is that we're, like, open about it with each other. It's not some sort of secret thing. But I think that there are a lot of people that are like, oh, that's a red flag. Like, how are you know, like, first of all, gambling is bad, or, like, it's really bad if you're manic, or, like, you know, it's bad for financial stuff. So I would love to just, like, briefly just say how you play. Like,
please.
What is your approach?
I just, I don't ever bet. Like, in general with gambling, they say you should never bet more than about 1-3% of your bankroll. So however much you can afford to gamble, mm-hmm. which people who are, like, opposed to gambling would say is none. But, like, so I started with, and all these sites, you spend, like, $5 and you get, like, $150, $200 in bonus bets and stuff. So I started with, like, a very minimal initial investment, $40 maybe. Mm-hmm. And then have just used that. I just make teeny tiny little $1 and $2 bets. Sometimes I'll put, like, 25 cents on, like, a crazy parlay where, like, you know, you have to win several legs. So, like, you don't just have to have one game go the way that you bet on, but several, right? and also I don't do any of the bad habits that you've learned about gambling. I don't chase my losses. I don't bet more than I can afford to lose, mm-hmm. any of that kind of stuff. And I've got, like, a steady little income stream going.
That is the other thing for me when I was like, okay, so we're doing sports betting. I was like, is this okay? And I was like, how would you feel about, like, if you do well, or, like, what, not even if you do well, you know, at the end of the week or every couple days, like, put half in the bank account because you routinely win. So it's like every night I'm like, oh, $50. Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
So it's a nice little stream.
Yeah. And coming, like, in. I hedge my bets and, like, I do all of the stuff. So, like, and I mean, in general, it's not like I'm, like, winning some huge amount of money, but, like, I don't know, like, 20, 30, 40 bucks a day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, on average.
Mm-hmm.
That's my number one obsession. It's been a great way to just ignore what's going on in the world and get lost in this, into, like, just developing, like, a passion for the outcome of, like, the Marquette-Villanova basketball game.
I've been really enjoying basketball, too.
Me too.
My first obsession is that 1946, the film that I've been talking about since probably we started this podcast, has a theater run.
Hell
yeah. We're doing
yeah.
a cinema run in L.A., New York, and London.
Yes.
The first week of December. It's soon. We're hoping to, like, sell out all the theaters, so it makes a really big splash. We're qualifying for the Academy Award.
That's so huge.
And there has not been an Academy – there's only been one Academy Award winning composer that's mm-hmm. been a woman in the last, like, 30 years.
But you're up for it.
So it's overdue.
You're in contention, like, for your consideration, right?
Yeah, maybe it won't be for this one. But, I mean, it would be
it's huge.
Exciting.
I mean, so the fact that you've gone through the whole submission process and everything, and I didn't realize what a big doing that was.
Yeah.
But that's fucking rad. And that, like, the director did the work to get y'all mm-hmm. in that position.
Yes. So it's exciting. So if you live any of the cities or around the cities and want to see 1946,
get your butt down there.
The film about the mistranslation of the Bible, about the first time the word homosexual entered the Bible. It is a phenomenal documentary. I made all the music for it, and I wrote an original song at the end. It's just very good. Please go see it.
You talked to somebody who was like, I thought it was just the song that you did.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, bucko.
Ed thought.
Oh, Ed from the movie.
Ed in the film. Yeah, when I was talking to him, I was like, no, I made all of the music. Any music you hear in the film, I made.
You hear that little twinkle, that little thud of that drama? Yeah, that was me.
That was me. That was that.
I'm just so proud of you. And I think it's just the beginning for that film and for your whole composing career.
Thank you, honey.
My second obsession is my new tattoo. I got a beautiful from Trudy Kaiser at Lucky's Tattoo in East Hampton, Massachusetts. And she's done, this is my third tattoo from her. And I was so excited to get it off of her, like on her, under her books, because she fills up like months and months in advance. And she's like in super high demand. Like she was already in high demand when I first got tattooed by her several years ago. God, that was like 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. But now, like, her talent, I mean, she's just is so skilled. And it takes forever to get it in. But anyway, she did a beautiful chickadee on my right arm. I'm just absolutely in love with. And it's I just so can't pretty. Recommend her highly enough. She's Trudy Kaiser on Instagram. If you want to check out her stuff.
Love it.
Yeah.
I love that tattoo.
And what's your next obsession?
My next obsession is, like, not a fun obsession.
Ooh, yeah.
It's just, it's, like, an actual obsession that it's been hard for me to leave the house.
Because, as we have said at the very beginning of the pod, yeah. Remember, obsessions don't have to be fun. Yeah. But anyway, sorry, leaving the house.
Yeah, it's true. This one's difficult. I am dealing with some, like, paranoia, but it's mostly, like, I don't feel it when I, like, leave the house in my car. I just feel paranoid when I start walking outside. Mm. And I feel like I'm being followed and watched. Mm-hmm. And so I am like, I'm scared to walk the dog. So I'm just like, there's some, I feel like cars are orchestrating, fear like tactics. Yeah. Like I'm going to, it's really like, I'm like, why did that car slow down? Why did that car pull in there? Or their lights are still on. Or, you know, it's like, I feel like I'm hyper watching everything. And, like, I've always kind of been that way. I'm always fearful. I mean, I feel like that's, like, every person of trauma, like, being like, how do I make sure I don't get harmed again, you know? But it's just, like, it's kind of at a fever pitch right now. I think probably because the sun is going down so early. So I just, So I'm trying to work on, like, ooh, how do I feel safe being outside?
Yeah. You know? And I think too, like, I don't know. I think that totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think being like growing up, being like socialized as a woman, like mm-hmm. you have to be vigilant, like mm-hmm. walking around. You absolutely do. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, you don't have to go far to find, like you've had traumatic experiences. It totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. And add on top of that, that you're more prone to that kind of anxiety because of your mood disorder. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that just makes sense, but I'm also just sorry you've been dealing with it.
Well, I think it's also like, I have experienced stalking before. Yeah. Like, I've also like, you know, my life as a somewhat public figure has been like, I've experienced it. I know what it feels like. And so I don't know, having those feelings sort of return or just so. And if you're stalking me or you're following me, can you please stop?
Yeah.
I'm scared.
Or at least don't be so obvious about it. but I understand that. And I know that that's nothing to sneeze at. Like that sucks. But I hope that we can take some steps to make you feel more safe, you know, and I'll step in and I'll walk the fucking dogs for now. I mentioned this earlier, but I'm reading like the weirdest pairing of books right now. So I'm like a little, like, I don't know, 3/4 of the way done with George W. Bush's awful book and The Liberation of Iraq. And the other book I'm reading is this book that just came out. And I saw it at the library and I was kind of interested, but it looked kind of hokey. But then I read a review of it in the New York Times and I was like, okay. Like, it sounds kind of legit. Like, not just like a little puff piece, like a legit biography, but it's about Madonna. It's by Mary Gabriel, and it's called Madonna, A Rebel Life. It's this big, like 400-pound biography that just came out. And it's not very well written, but I'm learning a lot, and it's really interesting. And I'm also just like, it's so wild that you performed with her, because I'm just like remembering and like really understanding, like, holy shit. I mean, you're talking about somebody who was just like, I mean, she changed the whole fucking world of pop music. Like, there's just no way to overstate her influence and like what a huge deal she is. And also that she mentions, like, when I saw it at the library, I was like, oh, I wonder if her performance at the VMAs is mentioned in here, because it's such a chunky, it's a huge biography.
It was the Grammys.
Sorry, the Grammys. Sorry. God damn it. So I looked in the index and there were like 50 mentions of Mary Lambert. And so I was like, my heart went in my throat. I was like, oh my God. But I was like, why is there a mention of Mary Lambert on like page 65? Like, this is weird. And so I flipped to it. And it turns out it is Mary Lambert, the film director, who directed like all of her music videos, or a lot of them, That's so fucking weird.
Like, it is really weird that we have the exact same name.
And you said that she commented on it when y'all met.
Yeah, yeah. When we met, she was like, it's so, she said it. She was like, it's so weird that you have the same name as someone I've worked with. And yeah. And I was like, I know, because I get her Google alerts. Yeah. And it's always like, I'm like, oh, I must not be working enough because I'm getting everything about Pet Sematary. She's done horror films and a ton of music videos. And she and Madonna had like a very close working relationship doing music videos together.
Yeah.
She was instrumental in a lot of those.
And I didn't realize that Mary Lambert, who went on to direct a bunch of horror movies, mm-hmm. was like apparently this real soft-spoken, petite blonde from Arkansas with like a southern accent.
Totally. And she actually just directed the biggest Christmas movie on Netflix right now.
Really?
Yeah, so I'm getting, and people are tagging me in it, and I'm like, not that one. I'm not.
You know what, though? Like, you're going to have a career with that kind of longevity. And I think it's cool that that's like your namesake. Although I'm sure it's probably more than a little bit annoying.
We've had interactions online before.
Yeah.
And like, she's so supportive. Like, we both follow each other and that's she's been so, so supportive. And so, like, if someone tags me in something, she'd be like, oh, you mean this one? And then she'll tag me or I'll tag her in something.
It's like you're, like, when we would have to forward the people who lived here before and yes. forward their mail.
Yes, exactly.
And that's it as far. Oh, and then we saw Liz Phair in Boston, and it was an unbelievable show. It was
a great show.
The 30th anniversary of Exile in Guyville. She performed the whole album front to back with like a beautiful, the lighting and the concert film that was like going like projected behind her was just so unbelievable. It was just such a cool way to experience the album. It was at a really weird venue. It was this place in Boston called the Roadrunner that's like,
oh, yeah,
the balcony, which like when we scanned our tickets, he was like, oh, and you have premium balcony left seats. I was like, I don't remember doing that, but thanks, former self. And then we got up there and it was like concrete bleachers. I don't know how to explain it. Like,
yeah,
it was just big concrete steps that
but it was still general.
Yeah. And we couldn't find anywhere to sit or stand or just be like without being like on the stairs or like in somebody's way. Yeah. And it was like, there were a lot of fucking people there. Yeah, like it felt to me like it was like over capacity. It did not feel right.
Yeah.
And I kept noticing also like when we did find somewhere to stand, which we had to like negotiate with these drunk people for, they're like, oh yeah, and be careful because somebody slipped right there. You see there's beer and like the concrete was like all wet. So the whole time I was like, in addition to not even really being sure if I was allowed to stand where I was like trying not to fall and like crack my skull open. And also I'm getting old. My feet fucking hurt from standing on that shit for 5 hours.
My feet have bruises, so I needed to get new shoes because I was like, I can't keep doing this.
This is 40. Well, you're not, but
you're almost 40.
40.
You're cute.
40 and thriving, or something. Anything else?
I have these postcards.
Oh yeah, you do.
And I have been obsessed with them. And I just think people need to know that I am writing postcards to people.
Y'all need to see them too. It's not like the postcard that your mama would get at the Grand Canyon gift shop. Okay, these are really cute, custom designed, custom made,
so sweet
postcards.
Yeah, I just. You know, because I like to pack my own merch and I design everything and I do it from here. And I think it's fun to do, but I really like the personalized sort of aspect of it. So like people will order a postcard and they're like, can you send this to my friend, Brenda, who is going through a hard time? And like, you know, and then it's been really nice to send a little, you know, pep talk to Brenda. And I'm like, oh, this feels so good. So, and it's on super sale right now on my site. If you use the discount
Calm Friday.
Code, Calm Friday.
Sorry, I interrupted you. Yes, go, go, go. Bye, bye, bye.
But calmly.
MaryLambertSings.com. And then click on the merch store.
Yeah. But if your money's tight right now, don't.
No, look, this angel on your shoulder, devil on your shoulder. I'm saying bye, bye, bye. There are not very many supplies. Go now.
No, there's plenty of supplies and I will always be here.
Take out a credit card if you have to. Bye, bye, bye. No, I'm kidding. Okay.
Poems.
Are you ready to read your poem?
No.
Okay.
You read yours.
Okay. I have a poem called Suddenly Last Summer. Mm. This is by Lisa Jarnot. Jarnot? I don't know. I'm sorry, Lisa, if I'm mispronouncing your name, but I really enjoy your poem. Sun worshiper I, in the absence of the sun, in the things I don't remember, the unfriendliness of night, the neon night, and blue, blue night, the creatures on the beach, suddenly to remember the sun and all the creatures on the beach, suddenly to remember the sun and little sunstroke turtles, suddenly the neon night surrounding little turtles, all surrounded by the night upon the turtles on the beach, sea creatures and mergansers, the blue, blue night, the turtles on the beach all worshiping Apollo. Suddenly I'm thrown into your library, never to be what I was before, surrounded by a tiny light inside the dark and clutching little turtles. Go back upon the beach and remember the sun. Suddenly, surrounded by neon, go back. Go back to the beach and worship it. Go back to what I was before, a worshiper upon the beach, Apollo's, in the lavender, beside mergansers at the sea's night shore.
Oh, I have chills. I love that.
Isn't it? Poem. I know. Remember what we were talking about the other day? Oh. About the, how like the pavement makes me sad, like the highways and stuff. Mm. Like I found that same part of me that thinks about that. I was telling Mary, like, sometimes I'll be driving and I'll just think about like all the dirt and worms and like bugs and stuff that should be on the ground. Like, and that there are all these birds that like can't get to worms on the ground because there's concrete over it. And like animals, if they go across that pavement, will like get hit by cars and die. Like, and I'll get really sad about it. This poem like fills that part of like that part that gets drained from me. It fills it up, you know?
When she said, go back. Oh, so beautiful.
Isn't it?
I love that poem. That's one of my favorites that you've ever read.
Thank you, baby. I love that too. That's Lisa Jarnot. I'm sure that that's probably not how you pronounce your name, and I'm really sorry, but I think it's just gorgeous, just beautiful. Mm. Okay, what you got?
This is a poem called Gate A4 by Naomi Shihab Nye.
Love her.
And one of my favorite poets, Fatima Asghar, posted it, and I just loved reading this poem.
Ooh.
And please forgive my, I'm going to attempt Arabic in it.
You've got this.
Okay. Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal after learning my flight had been delayed for 4 hours, I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of gate A4 understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, one pauses these days. Gate A4 was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor wailing. Help, said the flight agent. Talk to her. What is her problem? We told her the flight was going to be late and she did this. I stooped to put my arm around the woman and spoke haltingly. Shuda shubiduk habibti stani shway min fadlik shubit sewi. The minute she heard any words she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for a major medical treatment the next day. I said, no, we're fine. You'll get there. Just later. Who is picking you up? Let's call him. We called her son. I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and right next to her. She talked to him. Then we called her other sons just for the fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we called my dad. And he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, they had 10 shared friends.
Mm-hmm.
Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took up 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling of her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade mamoul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mound stuffed with dates and nuts from her bag, and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There is no better cookie. And then the airline broke out free apple juice from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving it, and they were covered with powdered sugar too. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing with green furry leaves. Such an old country tradition. Always carry a plant. always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late and weary ones, and I thought, this is the world I want to live in, the shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those other women, too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that, baby. It's so beautiful. I just really love that. Like, a beautiful, just beautiful shared humanity.
Totally. Know? I know that so many people are feeling this, like, how do we get there? How do we go there? And I think we're in a breaking open that has to occur and have to confront the reality of what is in front of us and breathe into it and just be aware, because that is where our humanity has to come from.
Yeah.
In the care of everyone else's humanity. Otherwise, we are no better than other people who cause harm.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to be that.
Yeah.
I just love this poem. I think it encapsulates it.
I completely agree. I refuse. I refuse to let, like, a political kind of, like, purity test obstruct me from, interfere with my humanity.
Yeah.
I think there are, like, you have to really struggle to stay tuned into the right station. Like, and your heart knows what that is. Like, and there's just so much interference in you, but you just have to, like, you have to trust yourself, you know?
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing. That was really beautiful.
Absolutely. Thank you for your poem. And thank you all for listening and hanging with us for this kind of intense conversation.
We really are grateful, and we've really missed you. I will probably check in again before the 2024.
Who knows?
Probably. Yeah. I don't know. I've had fun, actually. Like, it was like getting on a bike after a long time, though. When I started recording, I was like, how do we do this?
I was like, ow. Wow.
Just get burned.
I was like, ouch.
Love y'all.
Love y'all.